Welcome to the Tom and Curly Show. I am Mike Lewis. I am here with Dre's. Dre's, are you out there?
I am. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing fine. We are substituting for Tom and Curly. The rumor is that they are in a counseling session together. We're not sure about that. They will probably let you know on Monday. But before we get into the news and the Black Friday discussion, which is required by law on the Friday after Thanksgiving, Dre's, I wanted to ask you, how was your Thanksgiving and what did you do? Was it tiny and isolated or was it a rule breaker?
You know, you know what? It was tiny and isolated. It was me, my wife, my daughter. And then we broke a rule, a slight rule. We gathered with a friend of ours, but it was kind of small. It was about three or four people at their house, the three of us. They had all been tested as well a couple of days ago. So we all tested. We all cleared the testing, and we were like, we're going to get together. What about you? How was yours?
Mine was small also. There's a couple of people that I have seen through the pandemic who are pretty isolated, and so it was mainly it was like three of us, four of us, so it was small, but it was nice in a weird way. I mean, for me, it was an odd circumstance because in the bar, we typically do this big potluck for everyone in the neighborhood who doesn't have a place to go, and we've been doing it for almost 20 years, and that was odd. I was always so used to, I mean, in one small sense, to be candid, not having the stress of a giant potluck is good, but the reason for it is lousy. And so, you know, I kind of missed the stress and missed the participation because as much as every year I'm like, I'm never doing this again, it turns out to be such a great thing that I'm super pleased once it gets going, you know?
I'll tell you, we have a ton of food at this house. I don't know why. My wife cooked like we were having the whole family come over, and it was just us, so we've got a bunch of food. But this Thanksgiving kind of sucked. I don't know. It was just there, not to mention the final football game, the Ravens-Steelers game got canceled, so it was kind of like once football went off television, it was like, what do we do now? Just kind of sit here and look at each other? I don't know. It was different. So.
Well, I guess what you do is you go online and start shopping, but Black Friday, there is, it's been a super mixed bag. If you are a small business that managed to pivot and get online, you may not have such a lousy Black Friday, but customers are scared. The Seattle Times was sent a reporter into Nordstrom where I think if I remember the number correctly, there was about 80 people in the store that can hold 16 times that. And that has been pretty standard. Are you actually going to go out and do any physical shopping? Or are you going to do shopping online, or do you just avoid the whole Black Friday participation entirely?
You know, once again, I defer to the queen of the house. My wife is the Black Friday queen. She loves it. It's like that's her holiday, right? I'm like, maybe close to Thanksgiving. It's definitely running a close second. She typically would be out late, right? She would eat typically on Thursday night and then leave late at midnight, 1 o'clock, go out and be gone until 8, 9 in the morning, right? And so this really, really was a bummer for her. She said she just kind of started shopping online weeks ago, right? That was the only way she knew to do it. Obviously, she hasn't been out the house, didn't get to go shopping, so no, nothing. I mean, it changed everything, right? Like, I'm used to her coming home with boxes and bags, and I kind of wanted a big screen TV this year, and you know what I mean? Stuff like that. So, what about you? How did it impact yours?
You know, I gotta say, I mean, I am really aggressively, I seek out local businesses to do business, but obviously you can't do everything like that. I probably embraced online shopping within maybe a quarter second of it becoming available because I don't like going shopping at all. Zero. And when I got the opportunity to shop online, even if it means I am forever wearing ill-fitting clothes, I am fine with that. If it means or stuff that I just never bothered returning, and then I went past the sort of the window to return it, and now it's just sitting. I mean, that stuff goes straight to Goodwill. For me, I never much enjoyed it unless it was a really small shop. Like there's I was getting something for a kid, a small toy store, bookstores, things like that. Those really discreet, but the big department store thing, I was kind of done with. As much as I actually really support I want to support local companies. So if I go online shopping for something, I may seek an online a local company, right? I'll look out a Nordstrom or I'll look out somebody who, who sells online locally. I mean, again, I understand Amazon's a local company, but, you know, you get my drift. So it is it is for me, I still try to direct as much money as I can to people who are actually in this area as best as possible. So for me this year, it's not going to change a whole lot of my behavior because I didn't really go out a lot to do it anyway. But I would say that it is one of the things I really like. And you and I think have talked about this in the past, and you've talked a lot about this on your own, is the support of local businesses, right? I mean, this is something that it gives you an opportunity to kind of recalibrate, doesn't it?
Look, I can't stress as much as possible to people, please support local businesses. Like, now's as good as time as any, right? Like, you get what you need quick, you get it fast. But more importantly, in Seattle, we have to start thinking about the culture and the texture and the things that make Seattle, Seattle. If you want that to stay, you have to support. We're now at the point where we're at the second and third wave of this COVID thing. And some businesses are like, yo, I made it through the first and second wave, but I don't know if I can make it through the third. Right. I remember talking with a guy at the Station Cafe, Luis, over there. And he told me the hardest time for his business is the winter. And he was like, look, we're getting the community involved early. So he had all of these efforts going around where they were raising money and doing things for them and other businesses early during the summer, because he was going, I don't know if we'll, he said it, I don't think we'll make it through the winter if we don't. So all the more, guys, tomorrow is Small Business Saturday. It's time. You know what I mean? Let's get out. Let's find, there's so many amazing small businesses in Seattle and so many resources to get to them. I can't stress enough. I'm a local guy, man. If you want a burger, go to Dick's. If you want some coffee, go to the station, Cortona Cafe. I mean, you know, heck, I guess you'd go to Starbucks too, right? I mean, it's all local, right? I mean, in your
entirely.
Words, you get what I'm saying.
No, entirely. And on top of that, there's some really, you know, you get, you know, as this person who owns a small business, you see what other people are doing sometime to encourage local business, and you just get this both. You're impressed, but you also get this wave of jealousy, like, oh, man, I wish, why didn't I think of that? That was such a good idea to do. And one of the things, I mean, the Seattle Times was talking about a popular toy store in Ballard that has set up its display windows with the products and a QR code. So you can literally stand outside, buy it, and pick it up right then. They'll bring it out to you. I thought that that was like, and watching the way, I mean, the QR code menu thing, which we've all probably run into a little bit, was a very, very smart workaround on the things that we were trying to do regarding, and we'll talk a little bit later about maybe we're over-indexing on the touching and not indexing enough on the breathing, but the point is that the touching, the lack of menus and whatnot, that people got very smart about how to do that, and now they're doing it as well with the things you want to buy if you can go up to a small store. And I got to give a shout-out to, and in fact, I'm hoping to get a couple of the folks involved in this on Cairo Nights next week. But the Intentionalist, if you haven't actually looked at the Intentionalist, you should. Their motto is spend it like it matters. And this is your guide to how you can find a local product. You know, if you want to focus on, you know, a black owned business or a woman owned business, if you want to focus on a specific product or in a specific neighborhood, this gives you that tool. Yeah. It is as smart a website, a local business website, as I've seen in this area in a long, long time.
I just want to say, one, it's ingenious, but more importantly, bravo to the people of Seattle. All of the inventive ways that these entrepreneurs, there's so many resources. Go to our site, mynorthwest.com. We have an amazing article up about this. There are so many resources that you can tap into. But being able to look at, back to the Intentionalist, what a great resource. To be able to go, hey, I'm in Bellevue, or I'm in Magnolia, or I'm in Kent, or whatever it is, right? And you want to find businesses in your area or closest to you so you can be supportive. I love it. I am a person who, to be honest, I'm so intentional about supporting local. Wherever I'm at when I'm in the Northwest, wherever I'm at, if I want something, I'll just go, hey, coffee shop in this area, and I'll look up and see, and I'll look, and if it's local, I'll go, right? And right on down the line. But we have to, I believe we have us. There's no stimulus check coming for our businesses. We are the stimulus check. Tomorrow, get up, go out, support a local business in the Northwest, right? Something. Spend some money with them. I promise they will be grateful.
That is extremely well said, because I could not agree more. And the fact is that what we have to do, and this is the one thing I don't really resent, let's just say, you know, the one big punching bag, giant punching bag, and we'll be talking more about them later because they are such a massive employer at this point. But the one giant punching bag in this area is Amazon. And what Amazon gets us with is not just its vast reach, but it's completely subversive convenience. You know, it makes it so you can be sitting there at night and they're like, man, I need toilet paper, you know, and you could and bang, you could just like and it's, and the problem with that is that every time you do that little thing, and trust me, I've done it plenty of times, every time you do it, you just didn't make the little bit of effort to look locally and see if you can find someone because of the, I mean, just do this exercise. I mean, not only can you use the intentionalist, which is great, but you can also do this. Do not go simply to the top. When you search for something, do not look at just the top four, because the top four are the companies that game it to be up there, or they're just so massive that they're already getting plenty of business. Drop down a little lower and you might start finding your local company, or put Seattle or Kent or Auburn in your search terms. And then you can actually start drilling down to the company that you could just maybe spend a little bit more time, but pay them, because that's actually going to pay a salary of someone you live near.
One thing I do, and this is just me being candid, make it fun. Like, sometimes we make this stuff, we're all so businessy
all the time.
Dude, chill out. Make it fun. Like, if you've ever been to another city, if I go to a city, Chicago, my wife and I'll go, okay, best pizza in town, or you know what I mean, and just start looking for things, or talk to the locals and find it. I'm saying, just make it fun. Talk to some people that you know in Seattle and just say, hey, man, me and my friend or my wife or my buddy, whoever, we're going to go out and grab something to eat. Give me a spot that you recommend that's local. You know what I mean? Shoot a text out. All of us are a part of like text threads where we're getting 20 messages
on Reddit, things like that. Absolutely. Absolutely. But let me ask you a question though. And this is all right. So let me just get back to some a little local social criticism. And I love Seattle. I've lived here 20 years. This is not
Please
me. But do you find that in this area, it's harder to get those really emphatic, passionate recommendations than it is? And when I traveled to New York and Chicago, the locals like take this civic pride in knowing, in first off saying, whatever you're doing is not the thing you should be doing. Here's the thing you actually should be doing, and here's the place you actually should be going. But it's not done in a mean way. It's like they have this civic pride about knowing a lot about their town. I don't find that to be as true out here.
You know what? Because our things are different. Like, our things. Like, you got to go back. Okay, what's our thing, right? Like I said, you go to Chicago, you're going to get some pizza, right?
Right,
but I'm saying, if you're in Seattle, it's like, what's the thing? Like, seafood and coffee? Like,
well, seafood's a one. Yeah, that'd be one.
It's pretty expensive, though. That's why I don't think you get the passionate, oh, you just need to go down. Like, I was in Philadelphia, and I wanted a Philly steak, right? And it's like, a Philly steak sandwich you're going to get for $12 or something, right? So it's easy to say, go on down there and get this, but seafood's a little bit more challenging. But you're right. I don't think I see the same passion as I do in other cities. But.
So we can, this is a chance to develop that passion, find something, learn something about something. And so when you get asked that question, like, what is your favorite noodle house in Seattle, or when you get asked, what is your favorite clam chowder in Seattle, or when you get asked, you know, where can I go get a good, you know, maybe even something to cook, or a salmon fillet, you know, I like it when people have strong opinions about their town, because it makes me feel, you know, like they care a little bit about it. And I know people care about Seattle. I'm not criticizing that. But I just like it when somebody really wants to engage and they actually know their town, and they want to tell you, like, you know, it's a point of pride to be able to tell you something about it, right? And you're actually very much like that. I mean, you're probably the worst person for me to make this complaint to, because that's exactly the opposite of who you are, so especially being a local.
Well, I'm 206-425-360-253, whatever you call them, that's me. I'm your guy. But I did. I started a while ago a site called buildingblackwealth.tv, right? Because I wanted to be able to shine a light on African-American-owned businesses, right? And so we partnered with the Seattle Seahawks, and we just shined a light on some amazing black businesses. I tell people, if you're looking for another resource as well, just to look for black businesses. I don't make any money off of it. It is literally just shining a light on businesses and saying, check out this, check out that. I found that people want to support all different communities. They want to support the gay and lesbian community. They want to support the Asian communities. They want to support all communities. They just sometimes need a resource. They need a way, an inroad into another community, right? If you're not from that community, I know it's one or two clicks away, but sometimes that click can seem like a mile away.
Absolutely.
And so I wanted to create a resource that just said, look, did you know that there's a black-owned sorbet company right here? That there's a jewelry company right here in Seattle? Did you know that there's t-shirt companies and candle companies? And you know what I mean? Like local, right? And everything is quality, and you're not going to look at it and go, oh, yeah, well, I don't want to, you know, no one wants to pay for something that's not quality. No, Seattle is dope through and through. Yes, we have some people doing things not well, but we have a ton more making really great, great stuff. And there's, I know I've said it, and I'm not going to stop saying it. Tomorrow, make sure you go support someone local. I would say support three local businesses, but at least do one. And let's just send a gift to our people that we love them by spending money with them.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. Welcome back. Tom and Curly Show. I very nearly said Kyra Knight. Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. I'm Mike Lewis. I'm joined with Dre's. We are going to, before I get too far into this, one, our text line is 98973. Please text us in. Tell us what you think about the show on this Black Friday. And also, this hour of the Tom and Curly Show is brought to you by KeelMortgage.com. Dre's. So when I suggested that we talk about this on the show, I know that sometimes I bring this up and immediately people just start scooching their chair away from me, or they start, you know, like ignoring me, or they say, oh, well, I got to get this, got to get my phone. They don't want to talk about this, but I think this is a pretty interesting subject, and here is why. So this is about the essentially the U.S. code that regulates internet companies and has allowed them to get so big. It is called Section 230. Trust me, you're going to be hearing a ton about this through the next year, next couple of years, because it's probably going to be one of the biggest, most expensive fights that's going to happen in Congress. And here's what it is. Essentially, Section 230 is the law that allows Facebook and Twitter. It allows Parler and Instagram. It allows all of them to function as what's referred to as a platform and not a publisher. And that means that they are not held liable for what is published on their platform like a publisher would be. Let's just say you're a newspaper and you publish something libelous. You could actually be held liable and you can pay out a lot of money. And in fact, Gawker Media nearly went under when they lost a lawsuit to Hulk Hogan. That's the type of thing that could happen to a media company, but can't happen to Facebook. So this is actually right now being considered for rewrite for different. Democrats want to rewrite it. Republicans want to rewrite it. Biden and Trump actually agree on this thing, except for very, very different reasons. Dre's, what do you think about this idea of how much liability should Facebook carry around when it allows this sort of open discourse on any number of subjects?
Man, I am really on the fence on this one because it just goes to the core. First off, they're really not, by definition, they're not publishers, right? They're not publishers. When I put a post together from the comfort of my own home and I watch my wife pulling a sweet potato pie out the oven and I put it online, they are not publishing that. I'm publishing that, right? And so I understand what people want. We've created a monster, and we're trying to figure out how to get around these issues where you have fake posts, you have negative posts, but you start finding yourself going, all right, well, you want to turn these people into, I don't know, like you want them to start policing every single thing, right? So they're monitoring everything that comes online. Well, now you start if that goes too far, you can start getting into freedoms and into, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. So let me ask you another question, because here is one of the areas that I think is really interesting. A couple of smart people have been talking about on how you can modify this, because I think you're right.
Okay.
If someone does that, if you put the sweet potato pie on Instagram, that is you actually publishing that on their platform. They give you open place to put it. You drop it in there. But how about this? So when you do post it, and the Instagram has this algorithm that shares that, I mean, intentionally shares that with everyone who has ever mentioned either hating or loving sweet potato pie. And that immediately fans out to millions of people as a result to then, spread your information, but also to give them more sort of reach for their advertising, which they are pinning on top of it. They're making money on it. When they write that algorithm, are they still as protected, you think, as they are when they just provide you with a simple publishing platform?
Again, I don't know. This is fascinating. It's a great question, because maybe that part, now they are now participating.
Bingo.
Right? Me publishing and just putting something up and it naturally being seen by my family and friends who are followers, etc. But the minute they start pulling it via my hashtag and sending it to XYZ or however, right, their algorithm begins to move things around. Yeah, now they're doing some work, and so they may have a responsibility to kind of account for what they're getting behind and what they're pushing out there. I don't know, though, because I still have my concerns. It's like, well, what is harmful? Like, a little kid twerking, is that harmful? Right? A man on there lying to his wife, is that harmful? Right? Like, where do we draw the line? I know it's easy for people to go to this extreme where they're like, fake news. I'm like, okay, well, what is fake news, right? You know what I mean?
Right, but you're asking all the right questions, right? I mean, this is what we have to, and what you could also say, I think with some certainty, is that, I always struggle with this because are we going to, I mean, I always question myself when I'm feeling like I'm saying things that are kind of just rooting for the home team. And I don't know that we would be as much of a leader on internet-based technologies worldwide if we didn't have this sort of like Wild West, right? And that's actually literally the name of a newsletter done by a local guy, Eli Sanders, that actually focuses on this very issue, because the internet has kind of been Wild West in terms of privacy, in terms of its reach, in terms of the spread of information and disinformation, all of that stuff. And we've sort of always been hands off, and the internet companies have always said, hey, you know, look how giant we are and how much billions of dollars we're acquiring.
Yeah.
How is that possibly a bad thing? And it turns out, well, it's not an easy answer. It's a good thing to have business and a lot of people making good money, but how are they making that money and who are they getting that money from?
See, my thought is, how is it possible for them to even do this? Like, there are so many people on social media posting so many times.
Right.
I could post 15 times today if I wanted to, right? I could go live. What do they do about going live, right?
Like, right.
You know, so now someone's going live and the way this algorithm works as well with all of social media is whatever their new thing is, if you use it more, it'll show it to more people, right?
Right.
Reels is the new thing on Instagram. They're trying to get people using them. If you use those right now, you'll get way more reach. Strangers you don't even know will start liking your content, following you, stuff like that. But what do you think? Like, because this is, where do you think the lines are with this?
I like the idea. I don't like the idea of I can be convinced that they are a platform and not a publisher. As someone who came from newspapers and knowing that literally I've had stories that had to go through lawyers before they were published because we wanted to make sure that we weren't held liable. But that also forces you into a much higher standard of what is actually true and provable and what isn't. If you have that sort of thing attached to you.
What would you allow Facebook to be liable for if someone posted it? Like, let's say 230 gets abolished, and now these people are now treated as a publisher and not a platform. What would you hold them liable for?
So here's the thing, and this is where I think I'm going for. I'm not sure I would hold them liable for anything, but what I would hold them liable for is simply the algorithm. right? Because this is where they're making that extra money on your sweet potato pie. When they decide that they go there and that thing gets fanned out to everyone who has said something. Remember, those suggestions you're getting on Facebook and Instagram, those are things that you have either reacted negatively to or positively to, but you've reacted to. And that's the way they get that spreading out there. When we all started on social media, it was just our friends. And then it would be, then you someone, some old high school flame would hunt you down and, you know, and all that kind of stuff would happen. That's not it anymore. Yeah. That's not it anymore at all. They have gotten extremely sophisticated when they suggest to you, like, hey, so-and-so posted a picture. They actually know what your interactions with that person were for a period of time. And their algorithms are gamed to do that. What did that one person really smart in that the Social Dilemma documentary, she referred to algorithm is a code with an opinion. And that's a smart way to put it. So maybe you regulate the algorithm that is doing the fanning and spreading because they're making loads of money on that spread because that spreads their reach.
So let's say this. All right, so that's what they're supposed to do. I'm trying to dial this down.
Fair enough.
Where is the censorship? Is there a censorship issue here for you?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm not worried. They're private companies. They've always been able to censor. They sort of don't want to because that destroys their own reach and their own like credibility to their fan group. That's why you have a Parler existing because a bunch of conservatives felt like Twitter wasn't allowing them free reign. And so that Parler then erupts out of that. That's maybe the marketplace that should exist, right? I mean, maybe that's the way things ought to happen. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I would say how I want to restrict them. What I would want to do is how they're gaming the system to create viral content. I mean, they've made us buy in. Like if you have a social media post that goes viral, you're rarely unhappy about that unless it was something somebody posted about you, right?
Right.
And so
I just go ahead.
I mean, I think that I like the conversation because I'm not certain where I stand on this. I mean, feel like there is something going on here that maybe should be dialed back. In all cases, when we were giving land grants to the railroad companies to build a national railway system, which actually happened as a result of those land grants, even though that was the greatest land giveaway in U.S. history. Then we started dialing it back and not doing that anymore. Once we had that thing established, and maybe we're now at that phase two where we start turning the rheostat down and saying, all right, you guys are established. You're billion-dollar companies. Let's make this a little bit more manageable and a little bit more sane, and you guys don't get a chance to make money on every little thing that happens in your social media. We're not going to give you that platform. Maybe that's what we need to do.
What is the posts? What are the examples? Give me why do they want to do this? Why do we want to make this change? Is there something? What are the types of posts that are bothering us and saying these types of things should not be, you know, they shouldn't be on social media? I understand, because from what I know right now, if it's X-rated content, it gets removed. I think we all agree with that. What's moving this?
Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. I'm Mike Lewis here with Dres. Dres, are you a watcher of Jeopardy?
Off and on. Yeah, here and there.
Not super committed. So I got to say, I kind of have jumped in and jumped out. I've got a lot of friends who are pretty passionate about it. I also am not a person who spends a lot of time on watching game shows, even though this is a good one, and I liked Alex Trebek a lot. Well, you folks all know in November, Alex Trebek died, and it's been a search for his replacement on the show that is really so closely associated with him. The guy who was selected, at least on an interim basis, is Seattle's Ken Jennings, who is considered the greatest ever Jeopardy contestant, and he's a likable guy. They've decided, well, maybe Ken is the guy to come on the show and take the mantle from Alex. Now, they decided on an interim basis and not on a full-time basis. They might be trying other people out, but at least that's what the show producers have said at this particular point. But he has been catching some flack from some old tweets, jokes he's been made on Twitter from a few years ago. And before we get into that, let's play a little bit of sound from him. This is him talking to Rachel Bell about being on Jeopardy 75 times. Alex Trebek ran out of things to ask him during the little chit-chat segment at the beginning of the show.
I remember one time he just got fed up and he was like, Ken, is there anything you want to ask me? And I had no idea this was coming. You know, I hemmed and hawed for, you know, 10 seconds. And I finally said, well, what did you have for breakfast this morning, Alex? And I'll never forget what he said to me. A Diet Pepsi and a Baby Ruth.
What? That is so unexpected.
The breakfast of champions.
And so he actually is going to be clever. People have been kind of excited about this, but now a couple of tweets, and they're bad jokes, maybe jokes slightly in poor taste. One about the, the saddest person you can see is someone trapped in a wheelchair on a hot day or something along those lines. And then some other joke along those lines. And people are now starting to...
Nothing sadder than a hot person in a wheelchair.
Yes, nothing sadder than a hot person in a wheelchair. So when those tweets resurface, now people are you know, expressing some consternation about that, at least internet people, maybe not people, but someone out there on the internet. How do you feel about your internet past coming back to haunt you, Dres? And do you think that that's appropriate in this sort of circumstance?
This is so whack. Like, 2014, come on, guys, it's 2020. Like, he's apologized. He said I said something stupid. I hurt people. I made them angry. I know we love to psychoanalyze everyone and go, he's not serious. You don't know if he's serious. That's the truth. You don't know and I don't know. So you give the person the benefit of the doubt. Let's take it, you know, let's make it simple and easy, right? He said something back in 2014. It was a tweet. It was stupid. He said it. It was harmful. Okay, so we got to move on, man. I mean, the way I feel is everyone's got some of this, man. Everyone's got some of this. We start combing through everyone's backyard, man. You know what I mean?
No, like, totally.
There's got to be something. I don't know which way you've been. Maybe you don't like cotton or you don't like satin, but there's something who you're going to offend someone. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. And on top of that, you know, just because you may have said it or laughed at it and you didn't put it on Twitter does not mean that you haven't done it, right? I mean, the problem sometimes is we're over-indexing on the people who've actually put it on Twitter and not the people who've done it, but maybe it's just not searchable on the internet easily from someone's desk somewhere.